Had to do some research, I have to say, I mean, Sophie. But one of the great advantages is using you in the phrase Google very well. So it was brilliant, and I spent a long time listening to YouTube, reading Wikipedia articles. I don't know how often you think you would hear, but you are all over the place. Women's Hour, actually, I found you a little bit of information there as well. So, but I think one of the things I found was it's such a humbling experience because I was scratching out, I think, an essay on Sir Thomas Browne or something in my second year of university. You hadn't even been born. And I suddenly realised this was a huge generation gap. I have to say, I did some research on the famous people that we've been working with, but what was amazing is this list of achievements that you've managed. Because not only are you a musician, I mean, we talked about this as being a musical journey, but in fact, you're a very successful businesswoman. You are a founder of a school. You're a writer, you performed with the LSO, and in 2014, I don't know if you remember this, but you were voted one of the 50 most powerful women you may have been disappointed, but who knows. So let's get started, and I would love to hear about the early days, particularly if you can think of any influences. What was it, do you think? I mean, I'm sure your memory doesn't go back to the age of two. But when we talk about picking up a violin, I just don't know how you pick up a violin at the age of two. What were the early influences that you can remember?
Well, I think my parents were both very musically inspired, but not very musical. And they both had a lot of children before, and then they met and married and had me, and they were like, this is our opportunity to sort of, mold this world. It was sort of maybe, it was great and also quite a mental take on. But they then heard about Suzuki methods, so they said that I would learn Suzuki violin, which you start if you don't know, when you're very young. So from the age of two, and I took my Teddy. He had a couple of violins and I started very young. And my dad, having had violins when he was little, given up, decided that he would also learn. So we learnt the violin together. And my parents were sort of extremely committed to this project. So my dad and I learned violin together. My mum, who didn't play an instrument, also did music theory lessons. And all three of us would enter music, ABRSM, the music theory exams together. And it was like a family activity. But we did it grade one, grade two, grade three, grade four, all three of us did it together. So my mum was like really proud because she was a musician and she always got top marks. And then my dad got top marks and she was that was her but then, so this is quite serious, like, classical piece. But also my dad was, although not religious at all, had this kind of like spirit of sort of Jewish culture in him, I guess. And so our house was quite nutty, and he would dance around the kitchen, kind of singing what he called his Yubikoi songs, which were basically sort of like Jewish sort of songs that you remember from his childhood. Never with any words, but just sort of dance around singing them and get the dog kind of like wild. And then often he would go, this is a thing that he did quite often, he would go and buy trifles from Marks and Spencer's, like big ones. And we'd bring them home and decide that we'd have a trifle fight as well. So it was quite a fun, vibrant thing to grow up. And then on my mum's side, my granddad was a trumpeter in the British Army Band, so he was at Al Alamein, and he was sort of really, really into classical music. So he had an encyclopedic knowledge of kind of classical music and was therefore kind of inspiring, up until when he started, say, but inspiring in that sense.
There is a figure that I really would love to hear about, which is this figure called Uncle Howard. Now, I know this is something that I've never met Uncle Howard, but
you know, part of the community, just sort of get on with life, not talk about what happened in the old world. But my Uncle Harold was sort of a little bit before his time in that he was really into kind of exploring Yiddish culture and Yiddish folk songs, and he used to put on these shows with and record sort of Yiddish folk songs and things like that, which in, I guess in the, what would it have been, sort of late 50s, early 60s is quite unusual. Even before that, actually, 50s. and anyway, he was progressive, and I, when I was first getting sort of back into, or getting into my Jewish culture and exploring it, I found these recordings that he'd made of his Yiddish songs, and it was kind of inspiring. And Harold actually, so he killed himself. He was at Oxford, and he met a Catholic girl he was in love with, and he told my granddad that he was going to marry her, and my granddad, who, despite wanting to assimilate, was very Jewish, and he said, if you marry a non-Jewish girl, and that's it, and that was that. So I never met him, but he definitely was a sort of quite an inspiring figure when I was exploring the Jewishness, because I grew up, well, I had very weird, like my religious background was super weird, because my parents told me that I could choose what I wanted to be. So I was, my mum's Christian, my dad's Jewish, I was nothing until I was about 10. And then I decided that I wanted to be christened. So I was christened. And then I went to boarding school and decided that I wanted to be confirmed because of many books on early exeat. And then when I was at Oxford, I sort of suddenly became like was drawn back to the Jewish roots and started to look into that.
Okay, so if I keep looking at my watch, by the way, so I'm really conscious of the fact that we've now spent far more time here. I'm doing this not because I'm very well aware that we need to move on. So if, I'm sorry to push this on, but there's so much I want to ask about your early life. But moving on to your secondary school,
yeah.
to Cheltenham Ladies, and I was quite interested about the whole constraints that you felt by your classical music upbringing, because I can imagine that ladies, you know, I'm sure you've learned a lot of theory. I would be quite interested actually to know how that worked out in relation with your sort of more improvisatory improvisation that you.
I recently went to Guildhall to look at, they do like a Saturday morning programme, and I thought, oh, maybe it'd be nice for her to go into the Saturday morning programme, and we went to watch it. And it was so, it just like took me back, and actually not in a really good way, because it was just like the classical music world has really not moved on. And although there's a lot to be said about that kind of rigorous sort of like doing orchestra and, you know, all the things that you do, it just felt so structured and rigid, and actually everything that I've done is like to say, well, if you want to play violin, you don't have to follow that particular path necessarily. And actually, you know, often in interviews people say to me, oh, what concertos do you play? And I'm like, well, you wouldn't ask Keith Richards, you know, which Bach guitar that he's playing. It's the same instrument, it's just a different approach. And I think, you know, violin, because it is a classical instrument and still kind of is mostly taught in that way, you know, requires people to go through this sort of very traditional path. And I felt like they were not having to do that. So I sort of, my poor daughter, maybe repeating the mistakes of the past, but she won't get paid at all. Some of that. I'm like,
I'm going to mind it. You're looking to strive to keep pushing it. So we move forward and we get into the unit, I guess. What did your music change there?
So I arrived at UNIV having basically so spent, you know, my time in Cheltenham, I would mean disfuller, I was sort of quite square and you know, chaplain's prefect, etc. and got to Oxford and went to the Oxford University Orchestra audition, and then was just like, kind of just felt like I was at a fork in the road and was like, do I want to spend my time also being the same, you know, doing the same sort of thing, or do I want to play? And so I basically put my violin away and didn't play it for 3 years and became a jungle DJ. So I ran a club night at the Coven, which is a club in the library. And I kept a bucket with wallpaper paste in my room. I was in that room, I don't know if you may remember, but in the sort of the building that's like past the Shelley Memorial, and like the kind of, the like, I guess it's not the good one the other way, and you had to climb up and up and up and up, and then there was a little door that was about as high, and you had to crawl under it. So I crawled through my hole with my wallpaper paste, and I would go out, took the morning flight to Oxford for my club night, which was fun.
But you read Russian history.
Yeah.
So that was also a statement, which was about music.
You mean about not doing music?
About not doing music.
Yeah, I just love Russian so much, to be honest.
Yes.
And I met my Nixon, and I think that sort of sealed the deal. I so at school I had, you could choose German or Russian, and on the day of selection, the first day of that lesson, I went to the German class, and my name wasn't on the list. And I went to the Russian class, and my name wasn't on the list. But the Russian class, there were like five other really kind of cool girls, and so I just was like, oh, I guess I'll stay here. So that's how I chose Russian. But actually, it was the right thing to do because my father's family was very rich from Poland and Lithuania, and it kind of felt like it was sort of, you know, there was some kind of roots there to learn the language of these sort of oppressors.
And some music roots, I guess.
Yeah.
This is where we get onto the music.
Yeah, exactly. I think, and literature and all of it, I just kind of absorbed it, sort of immersed myself in it all, really.
Yeah. So,
thank you.
it was a student band, and we came up with a kind of student band name, and then the band ended up being quite successful, and we were stuck with this name. So we started this band, we'd come from Moscow, we were back in Oxford, we were doing our finals, and the band was a bit of a lifeline, it was sort of super fun, and we were really bad to begin with. I mean, it was like anyone could be in it, there were 10 of us, it was all big. We did our first gig above the Wee Cheek, and it was really, really fun. And then we kind of finished our finals, and we decided that we would continue the band in London, and various people fell by the wayside. And we gained a couple of members who were sort of, you know, reasonably proficient, more proficient than the ones we lost, and decided to make a thing of it and go for it. And then became very, very serious about what we were trying to do. And it was at a time when Missy Sawney and Talon Singh and a lot of those sort of artists were doing sort of British Asian underground kind of thing, with sort of like taking the sort of Indian roots music and mixing that with kind of contemporary beats and production. And we, I guess, sort of were inspired by that to do the same sort of thing with our Jewish heritage.
And did you start recording?
So it all sort of worked from there, and we got a record deal, and I think we were part of a bit of a zeitgeist at a different moment with Gypsy and Balkan music. It was a real sort of revival of those kind of music. So it was, it was super fun.
And what came up about in terms of, is there any particular song that you...
We wrote a song about refugees, actually, which was quite prescient in its day.
Yeah.
You know, it was an amazing band, particularly
in Oyster
Boy.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I guess so. Gosh, I've got a long time. Yeah, we did a really fun one about the gypsy in the ghetto,
yeah.
which was inspired by this house in Smithfield, which Rosinski's room is. But we were a party band, like it was our
yes,
gigs were
yes.
wild, and I was on stage with a bottle of whiskey and it kind of
yeah.
you know it went around my head.
Can I recommend a YouTube
video?
Fantastic.
See, the height of
yeah.
it was kind of lecture, but the height of my sort of peak of everything was when my abs featured in Master of Eating Standards.
Thank you.
So, what are the dynamics of the group? I mean, as you came to
say, so was a boy.
Yeah, I mean, why did you continue?
They told me I had to choose between a big solo artist and a big band. It was tricky for a boy because we needed a singer, and this is when we were doing our first album. We were casting around singers, and we sort of had a load of demo CDs sent to us. And the record label had this one singer that they really liked, and we found the CD of this other singer who we really liked, and we were like, really love her. And that singer was Kate Tunstall at the time. She was busking and was doing her sort of thing,
yeah.
And so she sang on our album,
yeah.
And kind of came on tour with us. She was our warm up act, and she was the label signed her, and they sent her on tour with us, singing with us, but also warming up and sort of cracking and kind of a few gigs under her belt. And so funny, she said, "Ooh!" And my dad was like, anyway, so Katie obviously did super well and ended up, you know, with her illustrious career. She left the band, so they, the boys had already sort of been, they'd have one girl leave, and then it was like, oh, can I get another one? She's got several deals. So they were just like, you need to go. So I left, and that's good actually. You can't really, I think you can really do the two projects that we do much.
Yeah, yeah. So where did you go from there?
So Quincy Jewel was the first track on my solo album with Decca, and I actually, having been, you know, it's funny being in a band with six people and trying to write music as a six piece, it's very complicated and actually not ready to do. I used to argue all the time about his ideas, and actually on my own it's quite terrifying, but really liberating, because I was going to try to write all of this myself. I wrote the lyrics as well. Yeah, and that was what was quite interesting, was I suddenly sort of realised that I had this kind of well of content, and a lot of it was drawing on like this kind of unusual mix of things that made me, I guess, which is this sort of Russian Jewish, or, you know, Lithuanian Polish Jewish background, but then also this sort of deep interest in Russian history and culture, and so I ended up writing a song called Microscope Man, which is a song that was sort of inspired by the Orlando Fides book, The Whisperers, which is about sort of secret life in Tsar's Russia. And Microscope Man is a song all about a guy who used to write people's lives down on the back of postage stamps and then send the letters with the postage stamps sort of out to the Soviet Russia. So I wrote a song about that. I wrote a song called Yellow Chrysanthemums, which was about the line goes there in the photo where I used to be, a bar of chrysanthemum stands. And it was basically about someone who'd been taken off to the gulag and been replaced by a vase of flowers.
Yes.
So, yeah, I think I found that a huge sort of...
And literature, did you draw on literature?
Yeah, so I did the Rafe. The Rafe Five that I did it by Heat, but I did rap. unusual. I wrote a poem, so I was actually at Oxford, I did one of my poets that I was really into, was it was called Tuchek. Are there any Russians in the house? Tuchek was a symbolist poet from the 19th century, and he wrote a poem. Shall I say it?
Yeah.
And what that means is, the night between the lamp, the chemist shop, the minimum and dim light, even if you live for another quarter of a century, everything will be like this, nothing would change. You die and begin again at the beginning. Everything repeats itself. Evolves. The night, the chemist, the chemist shop, and the minimum and light on the canal.
Yes.
So I did
happy Russian.
Really happy, really, yeah. I wrote a track that I wrote a kind of lyric for, inspired by said poem that Ray Fiennes came along and rapped for me. It's the first of our time you ever rapped. But I might sing something.
Do you have a rap book?
In a well.
Yeah, no, it's just fine.
We can talk.
Yeah, we can talk for a minute. That's fine. I wanted to get into that poem, but
yeah.
first few things do things, then it
does. I mean, I've got the thing is, I've got kind of niche in the, you know, what I do, and it seems like that's quite people like, you know, Russian gypsies, the violin, and the thing. Actually, being able to improvise on the violin is not like that common. Like, because of the path that most people take, actually, a lot of really amazing violinists, like, you know, even Nigel Kennedy, to be honest, like, there's not a natural thing. You follow this very strict classical path, and so if you're not getting a piece of music in front of you, they could play anything, they wouldn't know what to do, because they don't know how to do it. Whereas because of the Suzuki background, and I don't know why else, but I'm able to kind of play anything and play along to anything, which is quite unusual. So that meant that lots of musicians kind of have asked me to play with them. So Paul Weller, I played just like some gypsy music for him. And then Rufus Wainwright, who's a wonderful Canadian singer-songwriter, asked me to play on his album. But it's quite funny because I had this, what's called a viola cu guarna, which is a Romanian trumpet violin. So it's the fingerboard of a violin, but it's attached to a trumpet horn. And when you play it, the sound comes out of the trumpet. And it was invented by like folk archivists, like field recordists, who would go out. They wanted to record Romanian gypsy music, sort of like before it died. But they realised that with their old wax recordings, they couldn't capture the sound of violins that were loud enough. So they invented this instrument to, you know, make the violins so the violins could play loud if they could record music. Then this instrument then sort of got left behind with Romanian gypsy musicians and kind of like became a sort of traditional Romanian gypsy instrument. So I then got my hands on one, and it became like a thing that I wheel out from time to time. Rufus decided that he really wanted to have that at the beginning of his album, one, two. But it was kind of amusing because I did the solo, and it started with this. I don't know if you've ever seen the band Tell Us the High Beat, the gypsy number. They do a lot of this kind of weird, like, scratchy stuff with their violin string. And it's a kind of traditional gypsy thing. And I started this album with this, and frankly, I had lots of people took CD back.
What other instruments are associated with klezmer?
With klezmer? Well, it's interesting. So originally, the traditional klezmer instruments were sort of portable instruments, yeah. Instruments that they could walk from village to village with. You know, klezmerim were like a kind of social class. And they were hired hands, and you know, people would book them to come and play. Actually, non-Jews would book them as well to come and play at their parties. You know, they were sort of just like professional musicians, and they were often played by the number of musicians who turned up. So sometimes they would, if they thought they were going to get a really good payday, they would take along extra people who couldn't play, and they would just put like chalk on their bows, so they would just cut more musicians. They could play by the musicians. Some of them actually wouldn't be making any noise, but they would be making noise. The original instruments were like violin, flute, cymbalum, which is like a Howard Dulcimer, which would be like worn sort of strapped on the front, a bit like a nice spoon sails in the middle. And then when the Jews were drafted into like Tsarist armies, they would then come back, and then they started coming back from sort of their draft with brass instruments. And so then sort of trombones and tubas and trumpets sort of started entering the kind of the town. And then when the big emigration to the States, clarinet and accordion and those sort of instruments tended to line up.
That's nice. I can see why you didn't put it into the top of the label.
Basically, a reluctant Stalin singing on his deathbed. Being a mom, and you need to be a freelance musician, you need to
so much energy and so much hustle and so much drive, and I just couldn't, at that point, just couldn't find it. And I was very lucky that, so when I left Austin, I went and I became a strategy consultant. So I had been working in media and telecoms for my first few years when I was in the band, before we got signed. And then I'd always like done a bit of work on the side, sort of as a consultant, for strategy consulting for various businesses. And so I basically made this decision, which was that I was going to kind of hang up my touring hat or whatever and go back into the world of kind of more regular work in the form of two jobs, one of which was the Jewish Music Institute, and then I also worked in a startup in Shoreditch that did big data for advertising, so all like real dark arts of the internet, basically kind of, you know, profiling people and then showing them out. But basically what happens now, but it was quite early, in the early days of that sort of stuff. So I did that, and then I was suddenly like, who am I? I mean, I know I'm a Gemini, but I had basically had like two LinkedIn profiles, because I had like Sophie Solomon, and then I had Sophie Yankovic, and Sophie Yankovic was my kind of like shameful other side, and I had all the things that weren't the cool Sophie Solomon. And I was like, party and they'd be like, what do you do? And I'd be like, I'm a musician, or not really. And it was all really confusing. And so then I was super, super lucky that I said, I just really want to get back into music, into the music industry, but I don't really know what I'm doing. And within the space of like sort of 3 days, two people, one of whom was Harry Briggs, who's another ex-uni person, who's a VC, and then another, and the other was Laia Larratt, who's the daughter of Ron Larratt, the amazing furniture designer. They both said you need to go and see Brennan Lamb. So, and it turned out that Brennan Lamb had a startup business that was like kind of 100 meters from my house in Hackney. So that sounds kind of convenient. So I went to see Brennan. He's an inventor basically, and he had invented a reimagined piano keyboard. So whereas the piano has sort of one dimension of touch, you press on it, he invented something called the C-board, which has five dimensions of touch. So it's made of silicon, and you can. It's an electric keyboard, but that you can press into with your fingers and you can mould and shape sort of sounds as you play. Super kind of innovative, won like a ton of design awards. He invented it when he was at the RCA and then has kind of gone from there. Basically raised sort of, you know, millions and millions of pounds and started one of the UK's kind of most innovative kind of digital tech startups. And so I joined Roland and his team. I joined the team when we were a startup of kind of 40 people, and now there's 120 of us, so I sort of have been there for 4 years.
But as in a musical.
So I run marketing.
You're in marketing? Yeah. They must meet you.
Well, the thing is, because I'm marketing to musicians, or to people who, you know, I work a lot with artists, so Corel, Corel is our chief commercial. Work a lot with musicians and artists, and then also on new product development, so making new musical instruments. We've got something very exciting coming out in a couple of weeks. It feels great for me because it's like the integration of lots of bits of me. And has the benefit of being 100 metres from my house, which is 100 metres from my school.
Right, so we jumped forward. So, yeah. Right, let's rewind.
Okay,
tell us about this amazing
thing.
We won't let you forget.
No, it's about school.
Yeah, I want your question. You explain the school, this is incredible.
So, while I was on maternity obviously I was kind of, after about 5 months of thinking, I wonder what's done, and I was like, I need to do something. I was having dinner with a friend, another father, a new baby, and we read about Toby Young's preschool, and he said, if he can do that, surely we can do it better, and we should do it in Hackney, because at that time in Hackney, a lot of people were going down the borough for secondary. And so we decided to start a preschool, and I was super interested in the idea of a school that put music at its heart, so where, you know, obviously very much in the public narrative at the moment, but you know, funding being cut for music instruments, music lessons. I really believe that all kids can play music and all kids have the right to play music. And if you're a preschool, you can sort of decide how you spend your money. And so we decided that we wanted to have a licensed and for free. So we started secondary school in 2013, and then in 2015 we started primary school on a, we were very lucky that opposite our secondary school, well, I mean, unlucky for the fire station, but they basically were closing the fire station, so we were lucky that it was kind of public use, so we got the fire station and we decided to open, do a primary school as well. And all of this can sort of worked out in such a way that the primary school opened in the first year was my daughter and like all of the 3,000 of our children were in the first year of primary school, and it looked like we'd been so organised. We started school for our kids, which we really hadn't started it. We started the secondary school, we hadn't really thought we were going to do primary, but now we're very lucky that our kids are all in this school.
Can I ask you? Yes, sorry.
No, and the primary school is like particularly interesting because we've designed a programme where So music is basically on a par with literacy and numeracy. So every child does music every single day. They do half an hour of music in reception. So the really little ones, they do like musicality, and they sing and they dance, and they sort of like have music as just like a part of them and what they do. And then from year one, so when they're five, they all choose a string instrument, so violin, viola, cello, bass, and they do strings 3 days a week. And every kid in that school, and it's interesting, it's a kind of really mixed demographic. It's in a part Hackney that's in the bottom 3% parts of it, but also kind of also very gentrified other bits of it. So kind of really, really mixed demographic of Caribbean, Turkish, and then kind of, you know, Hackney hipsters. And it's amazing because there are kids there who, you know, obviously do not have access to something so inspiring, and yeah, it's great.
According the question of sensible educationists from Frontier Foundation, something like 5 million adults learning, lacking basic literacy and skills. How do you think this is actually going to provide your pupils for the 21st century in terms of how is it preparing them for two things? I mean, to me, it's instinctively right.
Yeah.
On the other hand, it's probably something.
Amazing stories of kids who, you know, maybe lack confidence, and then, you know, or even sort of SEN kids who maybe lack basic verbal skills, and then over the course of the music lessons, it comes out in the music. That's just the way. So there's all sort of that stuff, but then there's also we're about to do a study looking at the impact of the music on, you know, on maths and numeracy. So we're pretty sure that it's
yes.
helping them with that sort of stuff, and the links between music. Yeah, but I mean, I think just for me, they can all do it. There's not a single kid who is there going, oh, I'm embarrassed or I'm shy. Like, if they start young enough, it's like anyone can do it. They don't have inhibitions, it's just natural and normal.
Yeah.
And that's amazing, that feels amazing. You know?
How many
children?
Yeah.
There are now 215, so small classes, it's 25.
Time's moving on.
Yeah.
Can we go to you told us a story about something
made the soup.
Is there any music you would like to
hear? Oh, we'll play the clarinet.
I think it's
the
clarinet.
Yeah, we're going to play something hazy, and then we're going to play kind of like cleverly wrong, which might go wrong, but I think we're